Well, let's turn now to the thoughts from our Week in Review panel. Today, we have Renee Loth, editor of Architecture Boston magazine and a columnist for the Boston Globe. Renee, it's great to see you.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Also with us is Tom Keene, former Boston City Councilor and a regular contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti Ideas and Opinions page. Hello there, Tom.
Pleasure to be here.
Okay, so let's first of all start off with your reactions to what we led with, and that's the letter from FBI Director James Comey that it's going to be reopening its investigation into emails related to Hillary Clinton's server when she was private server when she was Secretary of State. Renee?
Well, you know, I think it's early days or early minutes, really, to know what the effect of this is going to be. But the atmospherics are not good for Hillary Clinton today. You know, it's when Comey could not find any prosecutorial evidence in his previous investigation of the emails, you know, Donald Trump and his supporters said that he was a tool of the establishment, and now he's going to right the ship of state, you know. So it all depends on where you sit, where you stand in the situation. But it's, you know, it's just not a good day for Hillary. It just drags up all of the you know, bad odor around the emails for her, and it's not good.
Right. And I mean, just to reiterate, Comey didn't say anything in his letter to Congress about who the emails were from.
Right.
Obviously, we know nothing about what's in them so far. It's just that they will be taking a closer look at them, and they don't know how long it's going to take either. And I mean, Tom, we're 11 days out from Election Day.
Exactly. You know, every politician fears the October surprise. This is almost a November surprise. And we really aren't going to see anything probably breaking until if anything comes out of this, because Comey's letter was surprisingly tentative given Trump's comments. Trump was, you know, this is going to right the ship of state. Comey can't say what the evidence is. He doesn't know what the case is. He doesn't know if it means anything. And as Renee pointed out, he kind of says the investigation's going to proceed. We don't know the time frame. It very well may be that nothing comes out until after the election, in which case this kind of festers here, but probably doesn't really change the result.
Hmm. It's unfortunate, though, because, I mean, first of all, a lot of people have already voted, right? You know, we've had early voting now for about 3 weeks, I think. And so thousands of voters have already cast their ballots. So that suggests that this might not necessarily affect the outcome, especially if it hangs on until after Election Day. But it only just gives then more fuel to Trump's argument that this is rigged, that, you know, there is a secret, dark, you know, material here that hasn't been exposed, and, you know, let's push the election out another month or something. And, you know, and it's just creates more uncertainty and more turmoil in what has already been, you know, the most tumultuous campaign that I've ever covered.
Yeah. Well, let's switch gears here, but stick with politics for just a second, because as I was talking about with Anthony Brooks, Hillary Clinton was in New Hampshire earlier this week, and she was, as we discussed, surrounded by fellow New England Democrats, particularly interested in the effect that the presidential race is having on those down ballot races. And in a place like New Hampshire, the Hassan-Ayotte race is a hugely important one, obviously not just for New Hampshire, but for the Senate as a whole. And there's a new Monmouth University poll out this week that showed a dead heat, but 46% for each of the candidates, both Kelly Ayotte and Maggie Hassan. And Tom, your thoughts on the effect that the presidential race could have on the New Hampshire Senate race?
So until today's announcement from Comey, we don't know how that really plays out. It's been very clear that the Hillary Clinton team really believes that they have got a victory in the bag. The polls are in her favor. Up until now, they've been widening. And sensibly, what she is now doing is turning her attention to, okay, if I become president, how effective can I be as president? Well, you can be a lot more effective
if you've got
the Senate and if possibly you got the House, or at least, you know, the Republicans don't have a real lock as much as they do right now. So very sensibly, I think the campaign is turning its attention to these down ballot races. And I think it's reaping a lot of fruit. I mean, Donald Trump is, for a lot of people, poison. And it is affecting Republicans down ballot, particularly, I think, with a lot of people who Trump has managed to offend, which at this point sounds to me like about 75% of the population. And it's been women, it's been minorities, it's been immigrants. It pretty much seems to be maybe white males such as myself haven't directly been attacked by him, but that's about it.
Yeah. Renee?
what he said. I mean, I completely agree with that. I think that each individual state, though, has its own dynamic. And, you know, New Hampshire is not necessarily Missouri or Nevada. There are a lot of states that would normally in a normal campaign, which this is not, would not be in play for the Democrats, either in terms of the presidency or the U.S. Senate races. Certainly, Hillary is hoping that she'll have coattails in the Senate races, but there's still a history of ticket splitting in some states.
Right.
Evan Bayh, where is he running? Indiana. That's a good example where he may win the Senate race, even if Hillary doesn't win that state. The opposite might be true in New Hampshire. So it's hard to make a lockstep connection between the two, but certainly Hillary Clinton's campaign is pulling along the Senate candidates in many places they didn't expect.
Trying as much as they can to do that.
And I'd just add to that, too. The other thing about the Clinton campaign is they are really well organized in terms of get-out-the-vote efforts.
Yeah.
And their get-out-the-vote people will be the people that would vote for Democrats down ballot as well. So the extent that Trump is alienating some people who might have otherwise voted Republican, and Clinton is now bringing these people into her fold, I can really see a down-ballot effect.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting to note that, Trump continues to say that everything is rigged and there's a conspiracy against him and so on, but he himself is sort of talking down his own candidacy with the one currency that he cares about the most, which is his own money. You know, he has, according to these new FEC reports that just came out today, he's contributed almost nothing to the campaign in October. Something like $30,000 in rents, no money in cash to his own campaign. So, that's not exactly bullish, behavior on his part towards the Trump stock.
Well, Renee, I think the thing is he really doesn't have as much money as we thought.
Well, we'll never know because of those tax returns.
Yeah.
But let's leave politics, if we can, for a moment, because there was another really major story here in the Boston area this week, and that's the end of the three-week-long Harvard dining workers strike. Now, just to remind folks, this was the first strike on Harvard's campus in more than 30 years, and dining hall workers were demanding an increase in what would be the summation of their annual pay to at least $35,000. A year and no increase in health care costs for workers. And ultimately, according to the union, that is the deal that they reached with Harvard University, and therefore the strike ended this week. Here's Harvard dining hall worker Sandy Liu speaking with WBUR as the union voted to ratify its new contract on Wednesday.
They do a really good job, and I'm so proud we are winners. We are the winner. Thank you.
You feel like you got what you wanted?
Yeah, I was going to say thank you, the student. Thank you, everyone, to support us. It's nice.
This story became national news for all the obvious reasons. We have the world's richest university engaging in a long battle even before this strike happened, and this very public three-week strike over the pay for some of its lowest paid workers. I mean, your take on how the strike and this agreement concluded, Renee?
Well, this is the way capitalism is supposed to work, isn't it? We have had right now one of the lowest unemployment rates in the history of the state. It's something like 3-something%. Restaurants are closing down. They're shutting down for the weekend because they can't get enough waiters to stock their shifts. Right? There is a labor shortage, and that always is, in theory anyway, it's supposed to pump up wages. So this is an opportunity. I mean, if not now, when, to really try to close the yawning wealth gap that Massachusetts is suffering, especially for its low income workers. And so I think that in a way, I'm not surprised. There was a similar strike that was averted with janitors at the a number of commercial buildings earlier this month. Similar kind of dynamic, healthcare costs, wages, a lot of pressure on wealthy institutions to do right by their workers.
Right. I mean, this is almost too facile of a comparison, and maybe it's not an appropriate one, but it's impossible not to make because we also had this news this week from this McKinsey report that the managers of the Harvard Endowment were getting their bonuses too easy because the bar was too low in terms of how well they should be managing Harvard's endowment, and they were getting bonuses in the tens of millions of dollars. Again, like some people might rightly say apples and oranges, but this is all going on under the umbrella of the same university.
I don't think it's apples and oranges. I mean, I cannot believe that Harvard let itself get dragged into this, that someone didn't have a brain, to figure out that the optics on this are horrible. I mean, how on earth could you not give your lowest paid employees, the ones, by the way, who have the most contact with students on a day-to-day basis, and you knew where the students were going to be, you knew how the political types would line up on this, and the optics compared to other people who get paid tens of millions of dollars, this was just a boneheaded play on the part of – I think someone should be fired in the administration, whoever hatched this strategy, because this was not something that played out well.
Well, you know, obviously whenever anything happens at Harvard, given what this institution is, many, many other institutions watch to see what happens. And to that note, we did speak this week with Brian Lang. He's the president of Unite Here, Local 26, the union that represents the Harvard Dining Hall workers and workers at other colleges and universities. And here's what he told us.
We represent workers on 13 campuses in the Boston area, and our message to them is that the $35,000 minimum annual income that we've achieved at Harvard, get ready, because that's exactly what we're going to be expecting from you. And the next one up is Northeastern University.
Well, we'll see what happens at Northeastern. But this week, Tufts University, some 200 janitors there voted to strike if a new contract agreement isn't reached with Tufts and their union by Monday. So I guess, Renee, that's my long way of saying it feels like this is going to spread. This was a big success for the union at
Yes,
Harvard.
I think it is. And I think this is we've seen a little bit of this earlier this year, and we're going to see more of it in other wealthy institutions. I think, you know, unions these days, they don't really get a lot of respect. But when you're talking about these low-income, unskilled workers who have, you know, really no clout, no representation, you know, you see how essential they are, unions can be, to improving the lives of people, especially the lowest-income workers.
Hmm. Tom?
Yeah, I fully agree. I mean, this is – it's the domino effect is going to happen here, and it rightfully should happen here. This also plays into the political tenor of the times. Inequality of wealth is a huge issue. And it's, again, it's something that Harvard does academic papers telling us how bad it is and then perpetuates this in its own structure of employment. Mm.
Well, in the last couple minutes that we have here, the way the news has been going these past many weeks, by the time we reach this time on Fridays, I feel like I've been run over by a herd of elephants. So I am looking very much forward to hearing what your hubbubs are. That's maybe the happier, funnier, I don't know, less... you know, apocalyptic news that we should have talked about today, Tom.
Okay, so yesterday saw a stellar array of politicians gathered in one place. Boston's current mayor, a former Boston mayor, three city councilors, numerous state reps and state senators, the CEO of Massport, and even a member of the U.S. Congress. As we all know, these are fractious times. Politicians of all stripes rarely seem to be able to get along. Yet... they did. So it makes you wonder, what cause, what issue could so unite Boston's political elite? The answer, it turns out, a ribbon cutting for a new dog park in South Boston. That's right, a dog park. In one sense, it's depressing. Really, don't these folks have anything better to do? On the other hand, when it seems as if the entire world is going to the dogs, at least it's nice to see that maybe it's the dogs that can bring us together.
Definitely, definitely. Yeah. Hear, hear for the power of pooches to bring us together.
Man,
I love that story.
Rough.
Thank you.
No, let's not go barking up the wrong tree. Yeah. Oh, my God, make me stop. Renee, your hubbub.
Well, you know, Boston's affordable housing shortage, which seems to be getting worse every day, may now have a new possible solution in its toolbox. There's something called an urban housing unit, or UHU for short, U-H-U, fully furnished one-bedroom, very small unit that is kind of a mini apartment on wheels. It's been traveling around the city of Boston all summer. Maybe people aren't fully aware of that. And it's in Alston right here this week. There's going to be an open house on Tuesday for people to come inside and see how it operates. It's designed by the mayor's Housing Innovation Lab and with the Boston Society of Architects, I should say, where I also work. But it's an opportunity to go in and have a kind of hands-on experience France with what it would be like to live in a very small place, but that's beautifully intelligently designed. And these units are modular, so they could be stacked or rearranged together, two or three of them put together so that you could get a larger unit. It's an opportunity to try to drive down housing costs.
Definitely check it out. It's an idea
right there
worth
on
looking
at. Garden Street.
And given
Garden
that they're small, the open house wouldn't take very long to look at. All right, so my hubbub has to do with yoga pants, of course, because we all know, or maybe we don't, but we should know about the backlash that has happened over a Barrington, Rhode Island man's letter to the editor when he was complaining that yoga pants belong in the yoga studio and, quote, not since the miniskirt has there been something worn by so many women who should never have had it on in the first place. Ouch. But, you know, hell hath no fury like a yogi scorned, I guess, because women, I mean, especially women, they were holding signs of a certain age, went to Alan Sorrentino, the letter writer's house, and protested in front of his home. There was a wave of protest across the country, I've been told, as well. Alan Sorrentino has since replied. He gave an interview to the Providence Journal, and he said he was really shocked and he was dismayed. He felt like it was a crucifixion. People misunderstood him entirely. He thought it would be obvious that, you know, that his letter to the editor was a work of satire because, I mean, what kind of sad person would write such a letter? That's what he said. And I just want to ask him, has he taken a look at the comment section of websites recently in the past 10 years or the letter to the editor section? Because I think there are a lot of people who write these kind of things. So, you know, fury over yoga pants. That's my...
Right. Be careful about the jokes you tell.
Yeah, exactly. Well, especially in this day and age where there are lots of sensitivities for some right reasons and maybe some not-so-right reasons. But Tom Keene, former Boston City councilor and regular contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti page, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
And Renee Loth, editor of Architecture Boston and columnist for the Boston Globe. Great to have you, Renee.
Thank you.
Have a good weekend, both of you. We'll be back. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston.